Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt of the Kosher Scene. With me this evening in a pre-taped show at the offices of Sotheby's, I have Sharon Mintz, Senior Curator for Judaica, and David Wachtel, Senior Consultant for Judaica Books and Manuscripts. Good evening, Sharon.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Good evening, David.
Good evening, Chaim. Thank you.
I'd like to start the show by talking first about the 12 items of the Valmadana collection. A couple of days ago, we spoke to David Redden. He described basically what the various items were, but I'd like to go a little bit more in depth. Let's face it, they are not inexpensive items, so we need some explanation what makes them so special and why exactly these 12 items were chosen from among the 12,000 items in the Valmadana collection.
This upcoming sale includes an unparalleled selection of Hebrew Bibles from the Valmadana collection, including two Bibles from Yemen from the 15th century, two Samaritan biblical codices. One of them, David will talk about more in depth, from one of the earliest Samaritan Torah scrolls from approximately 1160s. Two Bibles from Ashkenaz, one from England, which is the only extant remaining codex from the period before the expulsion of the Jews in 1290, and another two-volume magnificent decorated Bible from Franco-Germany, Bible from Spain, a Tehillim from Italy from 1401 Bologna, and in addition, there are several other manuscripts featured, including Masechet Psachim, a tractate of the Talmud, an exceedingly rare tractate from the 1450s, and two beautifully illustrated books of blessings from the 18th century. It's an outstanding selection of manuscripts. In addition, we also have the most renowned Hebrew book ever printed, a complete set of the Bamberg Talmud from the first time that the Talmud was printed in totality in Venice in the first half of the 16th century.
In fact, the Talmud looks like it has hardly ever been opened. It's in perfect condition. Now, I understand it spent a long, long time at Westminster Abbey. What is the exact story with that? How did it end up there, and how did it get back into Jewish hands?
Well, to tell the story of the Talmud, one has to go back to the 16th century. The set, as a complete set, was ordered from Venice, apparently by Richard Bruarn, who was the first owner. He was a Regius Professor of Hebrew at Oxford University. And it arrived in England somewhere around the year 1544, 1545, at which point Richard Bruarn had it bound, and it is still the original binding and contains his original cipher. You can see on the image on the back cover of our catalog, or if you come to the exhibition, you can actually see the volumes themselves. And following Richard Bruarn's death in the 1560s, he left his library, including these volumes, to Oxford, and they subsequently were deposited for centuries in Westminster Abbey. In the 17th century, we suspect that the last time they were studied from was by John Selden, renowned often as the smartest man in England, but he requested the use of these volumes while he was imprisoned in the Tower of London, and they were brought to him for his use. But after that, we don't think that they were used at all, that they simply sat in Westminster Abbey until 1954 or 55, was it 50, I think it's 54, was the tercentenary exhibition of the readmission of the Jews to England. The Jews had been readmitted to England in the middle of the 17th century under Oliver Cromwell, and the Victoria and Albert Museum in London held an exhibition to celebrate that event, and among the objects that was present at that exhibition was a mislabeled volume from the Valmadana Talmud. Excuse me, at that point it was the Westminster Talmud, but it was labeled as a Mikraot Gedolot. No one noticed except Jack Lunzer. Jack Lunzer, who came to visit the exhibition, saw immediately that this was not a Mikraot Gedolot, but rather a Talmud, and he knew that it was a pristine and impeccably kept copy of the Bamberg Talmud. As a result, he set an appointment with the librarian at Westminster Abbey to find out what was the story, and he discovered that Westminster Abbey, in fact, had a complete set of the entire Bamberg Talmud, and that it had been sitting gathering dust in their library for many centuries. He asked if he could be permitted to clean and, you know, to clean the volumes, and he did, and at the same time he also counted to make sure that it was a complete set. And subsequently he made overtures towards Westminster Abbey to try to acquire the Bamberg Talmud. And Mr. Nixon at the Abbey told him that it would not be possible because Westminster Abbey considered the Bamberg Talmud to be as important as the cornerstone of the Abbey itself, and that they would never part with it. That would have turned many collectors away, you know, downcast, but Jack Lunzer kept this in the forefront of his desires for the next quarter of a century. For the next 25 years, he did not let up on his pursuit of acquiring this set of the Talmud. Eventually, he was able to come into possession of a 900-year-old copy of the Abbey's original charter, and he approached the Abbey once again and offered to give this to the Abbey. And he said, I would like to give this to you because I assume that it would be as important as the original cornerstone of the Abbey. And I think Mr. Nixon knew that he was defeated. And eventually they arranged a trade of the Westminster Talmud for this 900-year-old copy of the charter of the Abbey Charter, along with some supporting endowments. And in the end, it came back, the Talmud finally came back into Jewish hands and has ever since been known as the Valmadonna Talmud and has been the keystone of the entire Valmadonna collection.
And as David Redden said a couple of days ago, according to the Westminster Abbey, the curator, had he known what it really was, he never would have given it up.
Well, you know, we're all much smarter, you know, than we were 25 years ago.
Right. What are some of the other items that are of interest, that, you know, are unique, are rare, and very, both from a religious point of view and from an artistic point of view?
I'd like to draw your attention to two of the manuscripts that were created in the 18th century, Books of Blessings. And for those listeners who would like to go online, you can find all of these objects with their illustrations on the Sotheby's website. If you look up Valmadonna Sale and Sotheby's, this is lot number 10 and lot number 11. And these are little miniature books of prayers that were created for women. In the 18th century, there was a revival of Hebrew illuminated and decorated manuscripts. Primarily, these were miniature books of prayer used in households. Sometimes they were Haggadot, sometimes they were prayers for the Sabbath. These particular books that you're seeing are part of a group of books that were created for women who used them in their daily prayers. They include Birkat HaMazon, the prayers said after eating food, before eating food, and Kriyat Shema Hamita, prayers recited before going to sleep. And what's fascinating about these is they contain a series of illustrations relating to various aspects of the blessings to be recited. So, for example, that you see illustrations of fruits and trees for the blessings to be recited upon eating those items. You see a court scene with a monarch surrounded by his officers of the court, and this is a blessing that's recited when one encounters a ruling monarch, Shechalak Mikvodo LaBasar VaDam, that God has given of his honor to mankind. In addition, there's also an image of a woman reciting prayers before she goes to sleep, perhaps another indication that this was created specifically for a woman. The second book of blessings, number 11, was created either in Vienna or Dresden around the year 1725. And this has an additional three illustrations specific to the commandments, to the mitzvot nashim, the commandments that women are obligated especially to follow according to a Jewish law, traditional Jewish law, challah, nidah, and ner, to take a portion of the dough upon baking bread to light the candles before Sabbath and holidays, and also Seder Nidah, which is the obligation of mikvah, of Tarat Mishpacha. And it's wonderful. These were given as gifts to women when they were engaged to be married. Often the groom would present these as a gift to his bride.
I believe that was more in the Sephardic world than in the Ashkenazic world, no?
Actually, most of these books, this Renaissance, occurred in the Habsburg Empire. It started in Vienna and then spread outwards to the various principalities and dukedoms. They were created for the wives and daughters of court Jews, bankers, to these principalities. And it seems that the first book, Lot Number 10, which was created by a renowned artist, although not signed by him, but ascribed to the work of Zev Wolf Herlingen, who was the chief scribe artist, the most foremost scribe artist of this period. This first book has a title page which says that it was created according to Minhag Sfarad in Vienna. And we know, in fact, that there was a small a community of Sephardi Jews who had either escaped the Iberian Peninsula or who were coming from the Ottoman Empire in Vienna at this period. But actually, the primary audience for this revival of Hebrew illuminated manuscripts in the 18th century was Ashkenaz. It was not Sfarad. This is unusual.
I've seen such Sfarim before, but they were usually done in Italy by the Sephardi community, which is why I asked if it was more of a Sephardi custom than Ashkenazi. I was not aware that Ashkenazim also did it, although the ones I've seen for Ashkenazis are usually not as beautiful as these. They are much simpler.
We do have books created in Italy for Jewish women. I think those are a little bit earlier, maybe 17th century, mm-hmm. going into the 18th century. But they're not as magnificently decorated. These books that we have on exhibition are a particular group, a genre, where the scribes, who also were the artists at the time, created them. They're known, Meshulam Zimmel of Polna, Aaron Herlingen of Gewitsch, and other known scribe artists. And my colleague David is drawing my attention to the fact that the Lot Number 11, which is the Seder Brachot and Birkat HaMazon, has an original binding. Both books have original bindings, which include the initials SLB. And we've actually uncovered the fact that Sarala was married to Lefman Baron, and this is probably, we probably were able to know exactly which Ashkenazi Jewess was gifted this book back in the early 18th century.
Fascinating. What are some of the other items?
Probably the most striking group of items in the entire sale are the various biblical texts. And I say biblical texts rather than Bibles because they encompass a large swath of Jewish history and the history of the Hebrew Bible. The oldest piece, or perhaps the piece that represents the most ancient tradition, is in fact a Samaritan piece. I'm sure your listeners will remember that following the Assyrian conquest of the land of Israel in 722 before the Common Era and the disappearance of the 10 tribes into exile, never to return, that when Jews began to return to the land of Israel, those Jews who remained and maintained the Paleo-Hebrew alphabet and claimed that they were the rightful heirs of the 10 tribes, and of course traditional Judaism ascribes to them a different patrimony, that of being, you know, Kuthians or Kutim. But in any case, that small community, dating back as far as, you know, the 8th century before the Common Era, has maintained and persisted, albeit in very small numbers, to the present day in the area and location of Har Gerizim in the land of Israel and with a small community in Cholon. Once reduced to only 119 members, today they thrive at about 834 members. And I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek. They're still a very small community, but some of the texts that they have date back incredibly far back. We have a Torah scroll, at least a portion of a Torah scroll that is a lot one in the Val Madonna sale, that is written in the Paleo-Hebrew script by a Samaritan scribe on parchment and dates back to the middle of the 12th century. It is one of the four oldest Samaritan Torah scrolls remaining in the world, and it is in and of itself a unique throwback to the ancient Hebrew script and to the Samaritan culture. And that is accompanied, of course, by Lot 2, which is a Samaritan codex, that is, let's say, a book with covers and pages that also contains the text of the Chumash. And according to some of the scholars that we've been able to consult with, this may very well have been used by a Samaritan Nazir to be worn around his neck so that he would always have Torah close by. And that is a tradition which is believed to have been prevalent in the Samaritan community, although its absolute 100% attestation is still yet to be determined by scholars. Moving from the Samaritans...
I do have one question on the Samaritans. On the Samaritan Chumash, are there any serious differences between their version and our version?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there are about 3,000 relatively small differences, things like the way that a word is written, either male or chaser, with a yud or a vav present within a word, or el. And we find that kind of discrepancy amongst different, Jewish traditions as well in the writing of the text of the Chumash. But the most stark difference is when it comes to the text of the Ten Commandments, both in the book of Exodus and in the book of Deuteronomy, where in both cases the tenth commandment incorporates the command to the Jewish people, or the Samaritan people in this case, to build an altar and a temple on Har Gerizim, as opposed to the Jewish Bible. The standard Masoretic Hebrew text that we know, whenever it references where the temple will be built, it says, in the place where I will reveal my name to you. B'makom asher eret shmi sham, I'm not quoting exactly, I don't have a chumash in front of me, but in the Samaritan tradition, the text specifically calls for that place to be Har Gerizim. There are other differences as well. Some scholars, have spent a lifetime analyzing the differences. Recently, an elder of the Samaritan community has published an English translation of the Samaritan Pentateuch, so that it's available to your listeners who want to compare the text, to go to the library or to Amazon.com and pick up a copy of this and see what it is. But if you have the opportunity to come and see the scroll itself or the codex itself, you'll see that you probably won't be able to read it because, as I said, it's written in this Paleo-Hebrew script, which is the script that all Jews used, during the time of the First Temple, and was eventually replaced by the Ketav Ashuris that we know today as Hebrew.
At what point did we switch, by the way, to the Ketav Ashuris, and why?
You're pressing me a little bit, and I'll tell you that to the best of my knowledge, during the period of Bayit Sheni, during the period of the Second Temple, when the Jews came back from Babylonia led by Ezra and Nehemiah, they had, while in Babylonia, begun to utilize the Aramaic script that was used in Babylonia, which we today call Ketav Ashuri, and they used that as well. It's interesting, for instance, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the Megillot Midbar Yehuda, when we see text written in this, and that's already several centuries later, but even there, you'll see that the text is all written in Ketav Ashurit, except for the Shem HaMeforash, except for the Tetragrammaton, the four-letter sacred name of God, which is written in the Paleo-Hebrew script. So it took a while, it took over the course of several centuries during the period of Bayit Sheni, that the text was changed. You'll notice if you look at ancient coins from the first century of the Common Era, Judean coins, that they still have the Paleo-Hebrew script embossed upon them in their writing. But by During, I would say that the answer to your question is during the period of Bayit Sheni, during the period of the Second Temple, is when that transition took place.
Again, fascinating, and it's a pity that the show is not going to be long enough for me to ask all the questions, but we still have a few minutes anyway. Let's talk now about the important Judaica.
Well, you know, normally, Chaim, I would say to you, "Bame atchil," with what shall I begin? But here it's very easy because I would begin with Lot 1. Lot 1, the first lot, we spoke in the Valmadana sale about a 12th century Samaritan Torah scroll. Lot 1 in the important Judaica sale is, in fact, the oldest complete Ashkenazi Torah scroll certainly ever offered at auction, and by all accounts we've been able to determine, the oldest complete Ashkenazi Torah scroll in the world. It is, according to carbon dating, dated to somewhere in the second half of the 13th century, probably no later than 1270, and it has on its cloth, in its text, some of the oldest Masorah of Ashkenaz, things that have gone by the wayside, things that have been surpassed, shall we say, by other nuskaot in the ways of, in how we use tuchot and stumot. For those of you listeners who are not familiar, I'll tell you that the very way in which paragraphs, for instance, are set up in the Torah, some are considered to be tuchot or open paragraphs, some are considered closed paragraphs, stumot. This evolving tradition is reflected in this oldest Ashkenazic Torah scroll. We also find that the orthography, the way of forming the letters, is slightly different. For instance, it's very, very typical in the 13th century and the 12th century in Ashkenaz that, for instance, take the letter Shin. You have three legs on the letter Shin. You have a right leg, a left leg, and a center leg. All right, and the center leg is a suspended yud in between the two legs with the leg touching down to the bottom. But in Ashkenaz, they didn't bring the leg down to the bottom. And we have numerous examples of that. In this scroll, somebody has gone and meticulously tried to correct many of the instances in order to try to make this scroll kosher, probably in the 15th or 16th or 17th century. What we have done with this scroll is we have used a special multispectral photographic process that has shown us not only what the regular photography, high-resolution photography, shows us what's there now, but this is almost like an X-ray into the cloth to see what the original sofer did, how the original sofer formed the letters, where he left spaces, where there weren't spaces, and where, you know, for instance, I can tell you a famous example. At the last two lines of the Shirat Hayam, the song of the song at the sea in the book of Exodus, the traditional Ashkenazic way was to write those two lines no longer as a poem, but just write them as straight text across from one side to the other. But later traditions insisted that they be written as a continuation of the poem, and as a result, someone here has crossed this out, not crossed it out, but erased it by scratching it out and rewriting it. But because using this special photographic technique, we can see clear as day how the original sofer wrote the text as well. This Torah scroll is, I've sold several Torah scrolls now over my years at Sotheby's, and I would not hesitate to say that this Torah scroll has the potential to be the most important for scholarly study and for understanding the patrimony of Ashkenaz than any other scroll that I've ever seen.
What I find interesting is, first, it is a beautiful ksav. However, I don't see any of the tagin.
If you looked closely, you would see that there are tagin, and I'm showing you here on page 11 of the catalog. I'm sorry for those of you at home on radio, but you can see that some tagin have been added. All right, the traditional nowadays we always say there should be tagin on the letters shatnez getz, shin ayin tet nun zayin gimel tzad. Those letters have in fact had the tagin added, but that's a later tradition. Although it's mentioned in the Talmud. It's mentioned in the Talmud for mezuzot, not for Sifrei Torah. But here we see that there are some original tagin. In this case, on Mafreset Parsa, you have, on the Samech, you have a double tag. And these tagim are a much more ancient tradition. These come from these are attested to in a sefer called Sefer Tagi, a medieval sefer that lists the various places where tagim are to be used, not wholesale on every shatnez gets, but only in specific places and in specific manners. It also speaks about the different kind of letters. Like here you have a chet with splayed legs, you know, an ayin with a raised head. These kinds of specific letters and changes, some of them survive in the Torah scroll, others are only visible with the multispectral imaging. But this is a Torah scroll. We have an expert reports on this from Dr. Yossi Peretz of the Mikraot Gedolot HaKeter Bar Ilan University and Orot Israel mm-hmm. College in Elkana, who has done extensive work on this scroll. And, you know, it is his estimation as well as ours that this is one of the most important scrolls ever to come to market.
What are some of the other items?
Included in this sale is a extraordinary collection of Americana Judaica, which all came together from a variety of sources, which is what makes it so exciting that so many interesting pieces came out. And I want to draw your attention to perhaps, it's hard to pick favorites here, but I think the two things that I would focus on are the earliest known American ketubah that was created in New York in 1751. It's lot 57 in the sale, and it's a beautifully engraved document with a handwritten ketubah text that was done on May 15th, 1751. It was done for Chaim Levy, who married Shalva Myers. Her English name was Slo Myers, and she was actually the sister of the very famous American Jewish silversmith Meyer Myers. The border itself, the engraved border, is the floral panels are based on the engraved designs that you find in a very famous ketubah created in Amsterdam in about 1660 for the Portuguese Jewish community in Amsterdam. However, this ketubah is unique because the upper right and left scenes are completely unknown other than in this ketubah. In the general ketubah engraved border from Amsterdam, which was in use for about 200 years with minor variations, on the upper right-hand side you would see the image of a bride and groom, and on the left-hand side an image of charity, a woman holding an infant with a young child at her side. For this particular ketubah, which seems to have been created especially for the new Jewish community in the Americas, you have an image of a chuppah scene on the upper right-hand side, and an image possibly of sort of the new world on the left-hand side. There's a man deep in thought. Beside him, a woman is tending a child in a cradle. In the background, you have boats coming into a harbor, a man tending its fields. It's kind of the image of contemplation, of thought, of building a new life in a new place. And it's really an extraordinary document of the continuation of Jewish life and the movement from Europe to America, North America, in the 18th century. The other lot that I'd like to draw your attention to is, again, something quite unusual. It's a decorated Bible that was created in America some 200 years later. It was done by Morris, also known as Moshe Weinberg, who wrote it in Chicago between 1910 and 1912. And what's fascinating about this really monumental book is that all the Prakim of Tehillim are illustrated in ways which relate specifically to the text. And this book came with haskamot, with approbations from various rabbis, and Morris Weinberg was very proud of it. Within 2 years, I believe, 1 year, he created a small facsimile edition, which is rare even of itself. But this monumental book of Tehillim is one of the only decorated Bible manuscripts that I can think of in the Americas, maybe the first decorated manuscripts in the United States, biblical manuscripts certainly, that we know of. So it's an unusual, beautiful, rare example of a book that was used for to study from, to pray from, to helim, and illustrated in unique and innovative ways not found anywhere else.
What are some of the other items?
In addition, there are a couple of very important American manuscripts that specifically speak to our religious tradition. One of these is the very important circumcision register of Meir Durkheim. Meir Durkheim was a mohel. He was many other things. He had a shop. He made candles. But he was one of the few individuals in the American colonies before the United States, and then in the United States in its early years, who performed Brit Milah for the children, for the male children of the families of Jewish families around the country. In this register, handwritten by hand in Hebrew, Meir Durkheim records that he did his first Brit Milah when he was 26 years old, and during the next 44 years, he kept this small pinkas, this small notebook, in which he performed the Brit Milah 75 different times. It's interesting when we look at some of the names that he records in there are people that grew up to become people that we know of, and we know who they are, and we know when their birthdays are. And if you look closely, you'll see that sometimes they were circumcised not on the eighth day, but a month or 3 months or 4 months. In one or two cases, you might suspect that this was because of, God forbid, a child was ill or something else. But in this case, it often involved having to travel. We see that he does 3 or 4 or 5 circumcisions in a row within a very short space of time when he visits a city. And we've determined that there wasn't a mohel at everyone's beck and call, and that when he got to a city, he looked and saw who had been born since the last time a mohel visited, and that's when the circumcision was done. A similarly important piece to the attestation of the observance of Jewish tradition in early America is the register of kvurot, the register of interments, that was kept by Isaac Leiser. This is a manuscript that includes all of the kvurot, all of the burials that he presided over as the minister of the synagogue in Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia. And these would have been done between 1830 and 1858. And it includes just the bare details when the person was niftar, when the person died, and when the kvura took place. It is a relatively sparse indication in that it doesn't give a tremendous amount of detail, yet one cannot be helped but moved almost to tears when you notice that one of the people that Isaac Leiser buried is his own brother. When Isaac Leiser suffered from smallpox, his brother traveled to be at his side and nurse him back to health. And sadly, his brother, he was cured, but his brother contracted the disease and died. And this was one of the people that Isaac Leiser had to bury in his capacity. So there's, again, these are just some of the important pieces of Americana. There are, I have to tell you something, Chaim, we have only such a short time on the radio, but I would encourage your listeners to please come down. Our exhibition is open from the 16th through the 21st, from Wednesday the 16th until Monday the 21st. And open on Sunday as well. If you have a chance to come down, please do. We'd love to see you and love to show you some of these pieces. And yet you might not have a chance to see this kind of quality between the Val Madonna exhibition and the important Judaic exhibition. It's really something not to be missed.
I will certainly make sure to come to the exhibit when it opens up this coming Wednesday. In the meantime, I also noticed a couple of interesting things, like, for example, the illustrated manuscript. Micrographic manuscript.
What Chaim is pointing out is a monumental, illuminated, illustrated micrographic manuscript. It's a very large piece. It's actually about 4 feet high by close to 3 feet across. And it's made up of tiny, tiny words that form pictures and are included around and through the pictures. It's full of scenes from the Bible, going from creation all the way through other scenes in the prophets, Elijah, Moses, Aaron, the Garden of Eden. And it was created by a very interesting individual, Levi van Gelder. Levi van Gelder was born in the Netherlands. He lived in Amsterdam for a time, and he is known to have created four engraved such micrographic plaques. They're smaller, actually. They're maybe 3 feet by 2 feet, using Dutch script while he was in Amsterdam. And those are known. They're in museum and private collections around the world. He came to America and lived in Chicago, and he created two further much larger plaques while he was in America. One large plaque engraved has sold at Sotheby's several times in the last decade. It's a rare and expensive plaque. Only about 10 or 12 are known in the world. And the other example of his engraved art using English text is in the Skirball Museum in Los Angeles. In fact, what we have on view is the only known manuscript example of his artwork. So this is really unique. It's handwritten and hand-colored and illustrated. It's not another example of one of the known engraved ones. It's something that really came out of the blue, and we're very excited to be able to show it and offer it at auction this year.
How many lots are on auction in the important Judaica section?
Well, in the entire sale, which includes not only Hebrew books, but also silver and fine arts, there are 129 different lots. And in the Val Madonna sale, of course, there are only the 12 lots.
Right.
But there is, between the Val Madonna sale, where the lots go as high as 5 to 7 million, and the important Judaica sale, where there are some lots for just a few $1,000s, there is something for everybody in this sale.
And there is something for everybody to see, something that may have a special meaning to them. And we're just about out of time. In fact, we run a little bit over. Okay. Thank you very much, Sharon. Thank you very much, David.
Our pleasure.
Our pleasure. Have a good evening.
Good night, and thank you, one and all.